days of wine and roses. Laugh and run away.
This is Joanne Salisbury Troxell, and welcome to the Poet's Corner. April is National Poetry Month, and with me today to celebrate is Greg Keeler. Greg Keeler is a Montana songwriter, poet, writer, artist, humorist, painter, and professor emeritus of English at MSU. He also plays the guitar, harmonica, and kazoo. He performed in the Vigilante Theater Company's productions of The Lewis and Clark Show and Woof. He's published one memoir, Trask Fish, Alive, and a biography, Waltzing with the Captain, Remembering Richard Brautigan. He's written 10 books of poetry. He's recorded countless songs and painted the river and landscapes of southwestern Montana to local acclaim. Is that all you've done?
Well, I do a lot of eating these days.
Well, what about between 3 and 5 in the morning?
That's when I write. I get up and write my poems real early, then go to bed around 8.
Oh, that is amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Greggy, you're a Montana treasure. You belong to us. Sorry about that. We claim you.
All right, if you insist.
Welcome, and thanks for being here. We go back a long ways. You and my husband, Vern, were fishing buddies back in the day. Refresh my memory. How did you guys meet?
Well, we met at a party right here at your house, and he took me back and gave me some of his smoked fish that he'd gotten at Canyon Ferry, and that was it. I went fishing with him every winter for years and years.
I remember the old freezer we had on the back porch, and you two would be standing out there filleting these little perch.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be hundreds of them.
There were.
And I remember saying, well, isn't that against the law to get so many fish? And either you or Vern said we had to get them before the fish hooks got them.
Yeah, that's it.
I love those little perch and I miss them.
Yeah, well, for some reason, there aren't many left in Canyon Ferry. How could that be?
Oh, that is disastrous. Shame on you.
I think it's because somebody put walleye in there, and they eat the young ones, and so they've thinned them out considerably.
You know, Vern loved walleye.
I know.
But he still hated the way people messed up the environment by doing things like that.
I know he did.
So... I have a confession of sorts, Greggy. I Googled you. My God, you have had a busy life. You've had a momentous career in the arts since you left the flatlands of Oklahoma. You know, Greggy, over the 40-plus years I've known you, you've performed all over the place, so I should have known what I would find. But still, I was surprised. Your work is known nationally and internationally. You seem like such a nice, ordinary guy, Greggy.
Well, I hope I am.
Accessible. Tell, how did this happen, your life? I mean, here we sit now, we're looking back. And at some point, you couldn't have known that this would happen, but it did. The mystery of it. Tell us a little bit about your youth and growing up, the town you lived in.
I grew up in Stillwater, Oklahoma, where Oklahoma State is, and my father was an English professor there who liked to fish. And so just by watching him and being around him, I learned to appreciate both fishing and poetry, because he taught poetry, although he wasn't much in class like he was at home. He was a lot looser at home. Once he came and substitute taught a college class I had in American literature, and I thought, who is this formal guy, you know, because he was always joking and stuff at home. But students liked him, and then he became department head. But I grew up fishing in Oklahoma on the little ponds and creeks, and wherever I could find a fish, I'd go and I'd bring them home, some of them, put them in aquariums, because I just liked to look at them and imagine their little lives. And then I started feeling sorry for the ones in my aquarium and dumped them back in the lake.
You know, I was a fisherman as a kid. You know, my brother and I used to fish and fry the fish, and they were our breakfast, and then get our horses. You know, we're just Montana kids, but fish were just staples of life, really. But when you talk about, you know, fish in aquariums and things, I don't know if Fern ever told you this story, but he was fishing towards the end of his life, and it was much harder for him. He could hardly move. He had that arthritis. But he caught this fish, and it was a huge fish, and it was scarred. It had escaped so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And when he caught it, he looked at it, and somehow it was hard for him to really pull that fish out of the water because he had survived so long. You know, fishing was what I recognized is that fishing seems to have an incredible, passionate group of followers. For instance, Vern quit hunting, but he never would quit fishing, not ever in this world. And we lived on fish. And you had the feeling that if you live with a fisherman that's dedicated, you're never going to starve to death, no matter what happens. There's a resourcefulness. So I find that really, really interesting about Brodigan writing about the fish with the humpback.
Yeah, he wrote about all kinds of fish.
Yes, and he was like you in that respect. He really loved fish. What were you like in high school? You're a big guy. Did you play football, basketball?
Well, everybody wanted me to, but I tried to play basketball intramurally and would score for the other team, stuff like that, you know. So I was never cut out for that. I did run track and enjoyed that because I didn't have to compete in running after a ball or something like that. All I had to do was run as fast as I could or jump as far as I could.
I imagine golf never appealed to you very much either.
Never did.
And the trappings of that, you know, the camaraderie.
Oh, I can understand why people like it, but just was never for me.
Yes, I can imagine that. Who did you hang out with in high school? Because hanging out is what high school kids do when they're not in class.
Oh, I hung out with the less popular kids, you know. I was sort of a class clown, though. That's how I sort of got known among a lot of my high school friends and stuff and acquaintances, just because I'd go down the hall reciting obscene poems, put obscene lyrics to Beatles songs. So I mean, they weren't that obscene, but I like to sort of get people a little uneasy about what I was saying sometimes.
Yes, you know. There's something about high school that is a class society. It really is. And reminds me of the kids that used to stand out in front of the dentist office across from the high school. And I would walk to school, and I would say to them, "What do you think, guys? You want to go in the doors today or not?" They'd all go, oh, no, we got things to do. And they were smoking cigarettes.
Right, got cigarettes to smoke. Things to do.
And I used to tell the teachers, you know, I said, we've got some of the most creative kids, and they're hanging out there. I wish they would enter the door once in a while. It would be really wonderful. And they called them losers and, you know, whatever. But one day I went to school, and they parted. And they took a side, and they all bowed when I went through.
That's great.
You know? And they were original. And I think that we forget that a lot of those successes in high school is a flame that goes out easily, and some of those other kids manage a whole life of interest and intrigue, you know? But that's just my bias. That's all I can say.
No, I understand it. I like those folks, too.
You know, the other day you winged over a poem you had just written titled, Just Maybe. And it made me think about poetry and what it is. And I always love what Carl Sandburg had to say about poetry. He says, poetry is a journal of a sea animal living on land, wanting to fly in the air.
Yeah, he's got it right there, I think. A very scientific description, but I'll go with it.
Well, you know, really, I mean, how did we come out of the savorial sleaze and end up with wanting to do poetry with words? You know, it's kind of a mystery.
Well, with me, of all the different arts and media, it's maybe the easiest way to make something out of nothing. Like Shakespeare said, out of airy nothingness. That's sort of like, there wasn't a poem, and then there was, and what happened in between, a little scrawling and thinking, but there weren't any real images created, or there weren't any real sounds made when it was written on the page. I mean, when you read it, there is, but it's just, and it's shorter, you know, you don't have to have a long attention span to write it.
You know, it's interesting because the old bards, poetry came first. And they sang about heroics and so on. And as they were passed on, they refined it. So that really poetry came before prose.
Yeah, they didn't have any print when they started doing that. Or they just had to memorize everything and make things up and convince people they were important enough to memorize, I guess, you know, and carry down through thousands of years before they came up with a way to write it.
You know, it's interesting, isn't it, really, because it endures in some ineffable way. We don't quite understand, but we know it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind reading your poem?
Just Maybe. Here is my wife's L.L. Bean rough suede handbag. In the 40 years since she tossed it aside, I've used it to hold bait, lunch, fish, tackle, mushrooms, asparagus. Brodigan called it the death bag. He and she are long gone, but the bag is still in the back of my truck with its dozen perch and sucker scales, two shriveled chanterelles, three split-shot sinkers, one number six hook buried in half of a dried night crawler on an 8-pound leader, one frayed number 16 trued elk hair caddis, seven shiny swivels, and one scrap of payday wrapper, and maybe, just maybe, a hair from her brush.
I can't tell you how much I like that poem.
Well, thanks.
I love the details of everything fishing, you know, the catalog.
That bag has seen it all, really. It doesn't look like rough suede anymore. It just looks all shiny and mashed down, but I still use it mainly now to gather mushrooms in, but when Vern and I would go to Canyon Ferry, I'd like stuff 30 perch inside of it and lug them off the ice that way.
That was the same bag you went fishing with Vern with?
Yes. It was Judy's bag 40 years ago, or 45 now, you know, and then she ditched it after about 5 years, and I used it for fishing ever since.
You know, L.L. Bean, I don't know about that, the versatility of that bag. What I liked about this poem is it's very accessible. Your poems are accessible. They also have this other thing that goes on, and this poem is about that bag that seems to be attachment of the past.
Mm-hmm.
But the poem is also about loss. It's about how we deal with loss, how we recycle loss
into
something useful. And I love the fact there that all of a sudden I could see Judy.
Yeah, no, I hear her, I still talk to her in my house, our house that we lived in for years and years. It's been 9 years now, April Fool's Day, since she went. But no, I still find myself wandering into another room to tell her something that I heard on the radio or television or something. But anymore, I don't get sad about it. I just am glad that I thought of her.
That's good, because in some ways, you've not forgotten.
Not
but you're living your life, because life is really compelling, Greggy, as we know. And she was full of life.
She certainly was.
And, you know, I have an image of Judy in the park with Max. And she was playing with Max, whirling him around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such an ideal thing, that beautiful park on that day. And I looked at her and I thought, that woman loved that child beyond the beyond. She couldn't even talk about how much she loves Max.
It's true.
You know, I love that image of Judy.
Yeah, and she got to see him have kids, and so she got to see that things were being carried on before she went.
Yes, yes. So Brodigan, you mentioned here, and of course then it brought up Brodigan and the 80s to me, and trout fishing in America. And I started going back and thinking about Richard Brodigan. My students loved Richard Brodigan, Trout Fishing in America. And his, humpback fish, you know, and everything. And these kids really, really resonated with him. And it reminded me of the 70s and the 80s and the freedom of that. And what was there about Brodigan that was so appealing to you?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's hard to describe, because he was such a testy guy, and he could be pretty dark and grumpy a lot of the time, especially when he was drunk. But he also had a magical quality about him where he was... he loved language. He loved just the use of words. Like, we'd be sitting down at the Eagles here in town having a beer, and he'd say, "You've got a great beer grip there, you know. I really like the way you hold that beer. Let me see you drink that beer." He liked to say the word beer over and over, and I noticed in his book, in his novel, Willard and His Bowling Trophy, he has a few pages where he just says the word beer. One of the brothers in it liked to drink beer and would have a beer many times a day. Some French critic said of Richard's work that, his repetition of words was like he was recreating whatever he was talking about every time he wrote it down.
That makes sense in a way, doesn't it?
Even though he was a French critic, he kind of made sense.
You know, I always remember, Richard, there was this woman did this Emily Dickinson and thing, and he kind of was intrigued with her, and so we all went for dinner at the Baxter.
Right.
And he was drinking, and he cared so little about eating when he was drinking.
Right.
And somehow we all got these spreads, and he was smoking, and he put out his cigarette in the mashed potatoes. Things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember Richard smoking, so that might have been kind of I bet he took someone else's and put it out in the mashed potatoes.
Well, I don't know. Or he may have just smoked a cigarette just
to do that.
To do it.
That sounds like Richard.
You know, because I don't remember him either, but I do remember that because he was totally involved in everything that was going on, and eating was the last thing he was doing. He was drinking a lot.
Right.
And
he would definitely do that. He would definitely light a cigarette just to put it out in the potato salad.
Yeah, exactly.
When he was drunk. He wasn't. He was a really nice guy when he wasn't drunk, but he could get awfully cantankerous when he was drunk.
Should we read this poem?
Sure, let's read it.
I love this poem. It's Let's Voyage into the New American Home.
All right.
And, you know, today in Bozeman, I mean, we have American homes and hotels, and they're almost like a fever, a contagion. One breeds another. And I just kind of like this poem. So you start and I'll follow.
Okay. Let's voyage into the new American house. There are doors that want to be free from their hinges, to fly with perfect clouds.
There are windows that want to be released from their frames, to run with the deer through the backcountry meadows.
There are walls that want to prowl with the mountains through the early morning dusk.
There are floors that want to digest their furniture into flowers and trees.
There are roofs that want to travel gracefully with the stars through circles of darkness.
He's good. Yeah. He is good.
Would you mind if I read another one of his here?
Yes, okay. By all means.
This is from his collection, June 30th. Called Taking No Chances. He had sort of he would use an imperial Asian voice sometimes, so I'll read it in Richard's imperial mode. Taking no chances. I am a part of it. No, I am the total, but there is also a possibility that I am only a fraction of it. I am that which begins but has no beginning. I am also full of shit right up my ears.
No wonder the kids loved him, and we still have this tenderness towards Richard Brautigan.
It's true.
Thank you very much. Well, you know, Greggy, as you know, I love your last book, The Bluebird Run, a book of sonnets. You wrote one every day. So amazing. Many poets have found the sonnet confining with its 14 lines. Iambic pentameter is A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G.
I found it so constraining that I just stopped the rhyme. I keep sort of the rhythm in 14 lines, but anymore, don't make me do it.
In other words, you renovated a bit for human consumption.
There you go.
They seem so easy the way you did them. And when I read them, I mean, for me, those sonnets are like poet candy. I just read one after another, after another, after another. And so I was wondering if maybe you would read several of your own.
Okay, this one's called Ouzel Mode. To watch an ouzel bob its little life in and out of a stream is to know the way love can harbor separate worlds where strife between the land and water holds no sway. to use the crystal current as a crutch and live relaxed within the torrent's roar, we grip the facts of loss and learn how much we gain when we approach the river's door. To greet the sounding threats as something new, one needs to put one's heart in oozle mode and shrug off what the foam and boulders do, then take some respite where the water's slowed. So knowing, we won't need to question why we're underneath the surface or the sky.
I'm just amazed at how you do that. That's wonderful. Okay, another one, please.
Okay, the river. I called the river light, and it left me as fast as it could. I called the river wind, and it laughed in my ears. I bid the river last, and it fell apart before my eyes. Chagrined, I left the river to its own devices, but it followed me at night among the stars. I told the river about my crisis, and it held the moon until I held my tongue. I tasted the river in my tears, and it turned into an ocean. I held the river in my arms where it struggled until I learned the paths of my blood. I saw the river spin a leaf and realized the futility of fathoming the past for what will be.
That's a tearjerker, Greggy. It's beautiful.
Yeah, a lot of these in the Bluebird Run are kind of sad, but at the same time, they're full of hope, too. By golly, it's not just darkness.
Maybe just one more.
Sure. A stubborn beauty. This is for my friend Catherine.
Great.
She's a stubborn beauty.
Yeah, she is.
For you, a slow and easy rain, not snow, where April's darkened colors hold their own. For you, the blurry clouds pass soft and low, and budding trees assume a neutral tone. That sorrows come head-on and seldom swerve confounds us worse on bright and sunny days. Though nothing's in the climate we deserve, there's solace in the weather's rainy grays. When we heard that pair of sandhill cranes, then saw them flying low into our dreams, their feathers were the color of the rain. The past is not the future that it seems. With gray a stubborn beauty's in the air, no wonder, friend, that I should see you there.
Lovely. Absolutely lovely. Thank you so much, Greg Keeler, for being with us, talking about what matters to so many of us, fishing, words, and seeing the flaw and foibles of our human lives in your humor, your satire, making us laugh at ourselves and not take ourselves too seriously. Greggy, you are one complex dude. Today, we dealt mostly with your poetry and your friend Richard Brodigan. You've been generous, and over the years have entertained and delighted so many of us. Thanks for just being who you are. Just folks, know what I mean? And out there, you listeners, Google this charming man and you'll see exactly who he is, and you'll be astonished as I was. And say hi to him when you see him on the street.
Well, if you Google me, you'll probably see who I was, not who I am now. But it was interesting.
That's good to look back on an interesting life, and you've certainly had that. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Joanne.
This is Joanne Salisbury-Troxell from the Poets' Corner. Have an astonishing week and take time to sip the wine of life, smell the ephemeral, intricate roses, and read a poem. Bye now.